all this money offshore?
Well, Appleby, the company from which many of these documents come, has insisted that it's reviewed the allegations and is comfortable that there's nothing illegal that has occurred here. What about this issue of whether there's anything illegal happening in all of these exposés of the Paradise Papers?
You know what? They're probably right. Probably the lion's share, there may be a few cases around the edges, the lion's share of this is going to be legal because this is the system that is in place where these loopholes, these offshore vehicles, and all these sort of systems and schemes are within the law. But as I say, they are the newest, sort of cleverest ways of exploiting the system. And these kinds of systems are just out of reach for normal people. Most people just get paid and pay their taxes. They can't find expensive lawyers to find them kind of clever loopholes in Bermuda or the Cayman Islands to just save a bit more money here, a bit more money there. And so, yeah, they're right. As far as they're concerned, they've done nothing wrong. This is what they do, if you like.
We just have a minute to go, but your colleague Ed Pilkington at The Guardian has a new report out today. From Harvey Weinstein to Shakira, the celebrities with offshore interests, Martha Stewart, Madonna, Nicole Kidman, among those named in Paradise Papers documents. What about Harvey Weinstein?
So Harvey Weinstein turns out to have been involved in an offshore scientific research company. It's a strange company where several sort of well-known people seem to have put money in. I think it's now ended. But as you said, this just shows what a range of people involved in this whole thing, from political influence to royals to celebrities like Madonna and Harvey Weinstein, all involved in putting money offshore away from the IRS.
And what that means is the lack of investment in infrastructure and social services in the United States and other countries around the world.
I think that's right. And I think that's what really concerns people when they read these stories. You know, times are tough. Wages have been stagnating for decades for the average worker. There's this sort of backlash against the system, which we see with Brexit and with Trump and all these movements. And actually, perhaps part of that is because the money that could be going into improving things for most people, improving public services, improving basic infrastructure in the country, is being moved offshore.
Well, John Swain, I want to thank you for being with us. We will link to all your pieces. He is a reporter for The Guardian, part of the team publishing stories on the Paradise Papers. A very happy birthday to Kieran Krug Meadows. Democracy Now! Is accepting applications for our paid six-month internships. Check democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Big Waters Falling Up Tour, Tuesday, November 14th at 8 p.m. at the Paris Theater in Portland. Portland locals Big Water will be closing out their Falling Up Tour, featuring special guest Danielle Betancourt on the violin. Big Water will also be sponsoring a feeding for houseless people through AMA Global Care and the Paris Theater. Again, that's Big Water's Falling Up Tour, Tuesday, November 14th at 8 p.m. at the Paris Theater, 6 Southwest 3rd Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Outside the Frame's film screening of Leaving Home on Monday, November 13th at 6 p.m. at Portland Center Stage at the Armory in Portland. Outside the Frame will be hosting a special gala screening of new films by and with youth experiencing homelessness in Portland. The evening will also feature a Q&A with the filmmakers, and a Lifetime Achievement Award will be presented to Tia Plimpton to recognize her decades of work and mentorship with homeless youth. Again, that's Outside the Frame's film screening of Leaving Home on Monday, November 13th at 6 p.m. at Portland Center Stage at the Armory, 128 Northwest 11th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland.
Told me river is my land, took it all away. Now I'm taking orders from a satellite and the BIA. Oh, the BIA. CIA. There ain't no doubt about it, I'm gonna live without it, CIA. All through the branch of the realty of the BIA. BIA. There ain't no doubt about it, I'm gonna live it at it, BIA. All through the branch of the realty of the BIA. BIA. There ain't no doubt about it, I'm gonna live it out it, BIA.
Good morning. Sorry for that brief interruption there. This is I'm Paul Rowan. I'm Paul Rowan. This is Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio. And you just heard Floyd Westerman, great troubadour, Native American troubadour, who passed on a number of years ago, with the BIA, Bureau of Indian Affairs, blues, which leads into the theme of today's program, talking about honoring the life and legacy of the great American Indian Movement leader, Dennis Banks, who passed on last week. And with us to do that is a regular guest here on Wednesday Talk Radio, Jacqueline Keeler. Good morning, Jacqueline.
Good morning, Paul.
I don't know, did you get a chance to meet Dennis Banks?
Have I met Dennis Banks? I don't think I have, actually. Well, probably I think I met him when I was very small through my parents, but I don't really remember that at all. But definitely my father and, well, my parents and my uncle knew him from when they lived in Cleveland. And
that's right. I was going to ask you about that, because that you definitely had a connection there. Anyway, so Dennis Banks, one of the leaders of the American Indian Movement, which was founded in 1968. He was died at 80, didn't quite make it to the 50th anniversary of the founding. Not that he probably put a whole lot of stock in such things, but he was a major figure for a time when the American Indian Movement burst on the scene with bold actions like the takeover of Wounded Knee, but he also participated in kind of the first big Native activist resurgence movement, the takeover and occupation of Alcatraz Island in 1969. This probably well before you were paying attention to things, but you've since become a nationally known writer and activist, activist mainly in the field of cultural appropriation and Native masketry, but other things as well. And you participated some in the No DAPL, the Dakota Access Pipeline action last year, in occupation action in North Dakota last year, which was, you know, one could say directly in the line of types of actions that American Indian movement doing. So we're going to talk about the importance of Dennis Banks and the American movement in the light of the state of current Native activism, and maybe what it might inspire us in terms of bold action in dire times, because they were known for nothing if not bold and media worthy actions. So yeah, talk about what you think is the importance and legacy of Dennis Banks specifically, and we'll talk about the American movement as we go along.
Yeah, I think I think each of the key leaders that are generally viewed as the key leaders in AIM brought different skills to the table, and so Dennis Banks was Ojibwe, and many of the others, of course, like Russell Means, were Lakota or Dakota, and so I can't imagine really what my life would be like if AIM had never happened. I think that I would have lived a very different life, and so I think all Native people today we owe them something.
Well, what do you mean? In what way is your life different?
Well, you know, I think that their actions, taking it, really doing the kind of actions that they did, opened up the dialogue, broadened the perspective so that we could claim to be Native in a way that we could not before, the Red Power movement, Red Pride, all of that, I don't think would have been as possible to the degree it was without the American Indian movement. I think that there was a movement that was, that was going on, that was getting effect results, but I think it would have taken a different direction. I guess this gets into the issue that people talk about a lot, like respectability politics. I think that a lot of the they just brought a different energy to it that broadened the discussion and what was possible.
I remember I interviewed a long time ago one old American Indian movement guy who put it like, once AIM come along, we're no longer gonna dance for the white man anymore.
Yeah, I think we had pretty tough leaders in the past. I mean, looking at different associations, particularly in the early 20th century, with Sekala Shah and Carlos Montezuma, the work that they did was pretty extraordinary and very challenging. But I see, and then of course, in the 50s and 60s, a lot of Native people stood up for different things like the dams, but the political will was not there. And actually, ironically, it really began to gain momentum with Nixon changing the direction of Indian policy from assimilation and termination to sovereignty, to recognizing tribal sovereignty to a certain degree. And so, really, we were beneficiaries of the civil rights movement, of the work the black community did to stand up for all of our rights, and made it possible for Native people to stand up in a way they hadn't been able to before. And so it's,
of course,
so yeah, I think.
Well, that brought to mind, of course, here in the Pacific Northwest, the link between the fish in,
yes,
as a tactic and the sit in as a tactic is very pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
And of course that was, that goes back to the mid late 50s, actually the initial things,
yeah,
which I mean, and so, what's the chicken and the egg? It seems like obviously AIM owed a lot, as you're saying, to some of the older precursors, whether it was, what was Vine Deloria's group, the Indian Youth Council?
It is the National Congress of American Indians, which my dad's family were very involved with. Two of his relatives were executive directors in the 50s and 60s, Vine being one of them. And it was that they were fighting termination. And but I think that sometimes, when we're, I think that having people been willing to be very, very bold and I think really did help quite a bit. I got to spend the day a few years ago with Clyde Bellecourt, who is another Ojibwe AIM leader, And looking at, you know, he took me around Minneapolis, St. Paul, and showed me all the different work that AIM had done over the last 40 some years there, including running a legal aid society for everyone in the community, and which was the first organization they actually created. And it was really impressive, and I really felt like I knew that without this work, that the work I do today would not be possible.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to remind people this is a call-in show, and the number to call in and interact with Jacqueline Keeler, my guest, and myself is 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. So yeah, let's talk a little bit about obviously you must have studied this stuff later, but you mentioned that your parents, you had a direct family connection with Dennis Banks and AIM through the Cleveland chapter of AIM, where your parents had met as both relocatees from the relocation program, and where they ended up starting their family with you. So talk about that history of the AIM chapter. Talk about AIM chapters in general, but specifically the Cleveland AIM chapter.
So Cleveland was a relocation center. In the 1950s, Congress passed the Relocation and Termination Acts, in which the goal was to terminate tribes and relocate the population to urban centers, right? And so they had this relocation program that was for young people, 18 to like 34. And different cities around the country were relocation centers, and Cleveland was one of them. And so when my parents were there, there were some 20,000 young Native people there, probably the most since Tecumseh, fought the Americans. So they had a big political impact on the city, and began fighting on issues like against the mascot and working, my mom and other young Native college students, they used to try to help Native families that were there by putting on bake sales and raising money for their utilities. And they just really worked together as a community. And so Russell was there and Dennis. And so my dad had known Russell Means because, they were related. Russell Means' mother was Yankton Sioux. So she was a member of our tribe, and her family were relatives of ours on the Keeler side. But she had gone to school her entire life with my grandmother, and they were best friends from when they were very small. So my dad grew up having Russell Means come and visit the reservation. Russell Means grew up in the Bay Area, in the San Francisco Bay Area. So he was coming from the big city and kind of sneering at all the reservation people. And then my dad was shocked when he got to Cleveland that Russell was suddenly all with braids and being the biggest Indian there was, just a complete change. My dad helped Russell find the first office for AIM in Cleveland. It was in the basement of the Episcopal Church. And so they got a desk and a phone line. My Uncle Ed, I was visiting, my Uncle Ed still lives in North Dakota, and I was visiting him on the way to go to, a year ago when I was going to Standing Rock, and he was telling me how he and Dennis and Russell Means used to go drinking in Cleveland on Detroit Avenue at all the bars there, and just what it was like, kind of the movement, the period, that time period. So my uncle was living with us as a college student. It was a very interesting period, and a lot of what was the fights we're fighting today that are still ongoing have their roots there,
So the AIM was, as I understand it, and it seems like what you read in the standard histories is, was started sort of mainly as a Black Panther-like sort of community self-defense group because of just terrible police abuse and other things in Minneapolis. So was there similar AIMs there in Cleveland?
AIM was definitely started in Minneapolis to protect the community from the police. from police, the Native American community, from police harassment. And it was also started in prison. When I talked to Clyde Bellacourt, he told me about how he was mentored by an older Native man in prison, and that was where they got the idea to create the American Indian Movement. And then he got his brother, Vernon Bellacourt. Vernon was actually a very successful man. They often say that he was a hairdresser, but he actually owned a whole chain of hair salons in Colorado. He was a millionaire, actually. and so he actually dropped all that to help his brother start AIM when his brother got out of prison. Yeah. And so, I think there was the same impetus in Cleveland. There was the AIM movement, and there was also the Cleveland Indian Center, which was probably more the mainstream group, where most of the Native people belonged to that, was doing a lot of the social work. And my mom was, I don't know, my mom tells stories of her and these young Native college students. And they would like go and like if they knew a Native kid was being beaten up in high school, they would actually go and get him transferred to a safer school. They would just look out for each other as a community. Although it's hard for me to imagine a college student being able to go and re-enroll someone else's child in school nowadays, but apparently they could do that back then.
The sense you get is it's similar to the Black Panthers, which of course had the public image of the badass, a black beret wearing gun-toting street toughs who would get it on, with the slogans off the pigs, they'd basically challenge the police. Of course, the AIM, the AIM Aimsters, the AIM warrior types were, had a kind of badass public image too, certainly with the kind of as we said, occupations and protests that they were involved in. But behind the scenes, there was, the Black Panthers started breakfast programs. They also started legal aid offices, acupuncture clinics. AIM also was a lot involved in community, the kind of basic community support type stuff that you're talking about.
And they still are. I mean, when I tour the different, when Clyde took me to all the different facilities they have, the first thing they did start was a legal aid organization, and that still exists to this day. And they help not only the Native community, but pretty much all the different ethnic communities in Minneapolis-St. Paul to have legal representation. Particularly the issue is, of course, the issue of parents losing custody of their kids, which is a big issue in the courts there. And so they fight to keep families together, to keep them intact. Because of course there's a lot of racism in the way those courts make decisions, they are doing that. And they have a clinic. They have a free clinic. They also have a free dentistry thing. They have it all there in St. Paul. Although I should note there is a difference. They are two different organizations. The AIM that Russell Means led is a different AIM. They split off from each other from the AIM that the Bellacourt brothers ran. And so those are two separate groups.
Which could be another long, long conversation about internal politics of the American Indian.
Yeah, even today in Cleveland, there are two different AIM leaders. And one was a protege of Russell Means. The other one is in a sanctioned chapter of Clyde Bellacourt's. So there is this kind of back and forth. But I would say that, the American Indian Movement, they really changed the dialogue with these takeovers. Of course, Banks participated in the 1969-1971 occupation of Alcatraz. And it's so funny because my mother-in-law was living in the Los Angeles area, and she so wanted to go up there, be part of that takeover. And so it was definitely like my parents' generation that did all this stuff. They did the Trail of Broken Treaties in 1972, where they traveled across the country to D.C. and occupied the Bureau of Indian Affairs building. And then, of course, the issues that happened at Pine Ridge with Wounded Knee in 73, and then later his own arrest and trial And of course, the whole issue, which sort of hangs over everything, is of course the murder of Anna Mae Aquash, who was allegedly his girlfriend, and then was later targeted as an FBI snitch, and then murdered by actually members, according to the courts, of the American Indian Movement. And I interviewed Anna Mae Aquash's daughter, and I published an article about it. And you know, she spent 20 years investigating her mother's death, and then they were able to bring people to trial. And it was very sad to find out that it was not the FBI, but it was members of the American Indian Movement. And of course, she and other folks, particularly AIM women who have made these allegations, have been denigrated and basically victims of ad hominem attacks. And so it's a difficult history, because there is the history of standing up with guns. Is also, then the other thing is the treatment of women in the movement. This is actually what made my parents separate themselves from AIM, was the issue of sexual assault and the way women were treated. And so that's that's another aspect of AIM, which of course was very common in the time period. And I suppose, as you can see, with Weinstein, it's still common today.
This is extraordinary. What's going on with all that now? And you brought up a lot of stuff. I certainly don't consider myself knowledgeable enough to really get into it deeply. And like most of these things, not really enough time on the air. But they had left to their own devices. They had enough baggage, as you're talking about, from the dominant society. Because I think in traditional Native society, there was probably a different relationship between the genders. But is my impression from my limited knowledge. But there's also the degree. It's unknown to me the degree to which the death of Anna Mae Aquash, for example, was also instigated by infiltrators, government infiltrators.
Oh, yeah.
So it's these things get really thick and really difficult to sort out all the strands, because you can't justify or defend killing among other things one of the best and brightest of the young AIM activists, from all accounts, was Anna Mae Aquash. Would they have killed her if there weren't voices encouraging him in that direction?
Oh yeah, I definitely think that was a COINTELPRO plot, and that bore fruit, and definitely their work of course got them the attention of the FBI and really undid the movement. And I think that there were personal issues. These folks were coming out of pretty troubled backgrounds, and that you can't really discount what that means to how they behave when they are in charge, for my parents, they were coming from more, I guess, they expected leadership to behave a certain way, and that wasn't always the case. There was a lot of just a sexual assault, and also there was just a lot of mismanagement going on. And when you put your heart and soul into something, you don't really know if that's where you want it to go after a while. And with Russell Means, the movement was, a lot of these things were already ongoing with the young Native community in Cleveland, and there was a feeling that he sort of took credit for their work, and then later sold them out. He took a $30,000 payoff from the Cleveland Indians to leave town, so that was a lot of money in the early 1970s. And so
that's not a pretty piece of history.
No, and of course with Russell Means there was the whole issue of him trying to avoid the jurisdiction of the Navajo Nation when he beat his father-in-law in the 90s and then tried to take it to the Navajo Supreme Court, saying that the Navajo Nation did not have jurisdiction over non-Navajos, which, of course, if that had gone through, would have meant that all the folks who are on the reservation who are not enrolled in the Navajo Nation could get away with murder, you know, with no oversight practically, and which is, of course, a huge problem. We Navajo Nation has jurisdiction over all federally enrolled Indians. So if you're enrolled in a federally recognized tribe, the Navajo Nation has jurisdiction over you if you're on their land. And what they don't have jurisdiction over is everyone who is not federally enrolled. And that basically opens up Native people to assault by mostly white people who come to the reservation knowing that they will not be prosecuted for murder and rape. And it's actually kind of a known thing. And so they passed the 2013 VAWA Act to try to give Native Nations jurisdiction in a domestic violence venue over non-Natives. So, but what Russell Mees was trying to do was actually even make it smaller, make it so they could only prosecute Navajos, and so that was a real low point. I think when these movements get caught up in personalities and feeding the egos of personalities, they really lose their way.
Yeah, I want to talk a little more about. Yeah. By the way, this is a Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm the host, Paul Rowland, every Wednesday from 8 to 9 in the morning here on KBOO. And I'm speaking with Jacqueline Keeler, a regular guest here on my show. She's a Yankton Dakota and a Navajo or Diné. And she's a writer and activist who lives here in the Portland area. And so we're talking about a lot of things, the American Indian Movement, specifically Dennis Banks and his role and importance. And we're talking, obviously, gotten into the whole subject of leadership. I was just thinking as you were talking, when you have these movements that are basically breaking completely out of the box of what had gone before, Black Panther, nothing really like the Black Panthers or the American Indian Movement or the Brown Berets or SDS had really existed, prior to the 60s. Something new was in the air. So there's the good side is that something new is happening, that people are taking bold action, that they're challenging the status quo, the establishment. They're breaking new ground. They're recruiting a lot of new, young energy. The downside is that you've got frail, flawed human beings who have too much burden put on them to keep these things going. And, it's different from like a real rooted anti-colonial movement. Algeria or somewhere. We can hear a lot of background noise there, Jackie.
Oh, sorry.
Just saying. Anyway, okay. there tends to be a reliance on sort of spectacular media events, which then feeds into, as you're saying, sort of it feeds the male ego to be put in front of the cameras and the bright lights. We saw that in a movement I participated in, Earth First, to a degree. Certainly the Black Panthers, that was involved. So, when you don't have a real disciplined, mass organized movement, there tends to be sort of the substitute with these charismatic leaders to keep things going, which, as I said, puts way too much psychological pressure burden on them that they're often not able to handle, and it doesn't really lead to the kind of broader, more successful movement that might be otherwise.
Well, I would say that that it attracts narcissistic personalities, who are actually not really great leaders in the long run, I think that our traditional societies, we didn't choose the guy who was going, vote for me. We chose the guy who was in the back of the room and didn't put up his hand. Do you know what I mean? Because it was, of course, the clan mothers and the folks in the community who really knew the character of the person who chose leadership. I think that anyone who comes up and wants to grandstand in front of a community is probably not a great leader.
Right. But at the same time, if no one else is stepping up, there needs to, someone needs to step up. So it's a paradoxical situation. So, you know, and you,
well, I think other people were leading, actually doing the work. And then, but they were basically pushed aside for someone who wanted to take credit. And that's what we saw happen in Cleveland. And but the work continues even when they go away, but it's just not glamorized in the same way. I mean, the work never stops. But I think in established, stable Indigenous communities, you know, grandstanders were just not regarded as good leadership material. Not, and I mean, it's great for white people to look at someone who looks handsome and brave and takes a nice photograph or, you know, gives a speech, you know, but that is actually not the complete, you know, profile of a good leader.
But I hear you saying two different things here, and they're not irreconcilable. I heard you saying that, you know, that thanks to Dennis Banks and Russell Means and the Belcourts and the rest of them, something came into being, the American Indian Movement, which changed changed things in Indian country and set the stage for a lot of positive changes. On the other hand, you're saying that some of the leadership was problematic, and that it maybe took away from other kinds of organizing.
No, I think those are totally compatible with each other. I mean, okay. On one hand, I do give AIM due, but at the same time, authoritarian power structures based on a male personality are completely non-Indigenous. Those are colonial systems, and to a large extent, that is what AIM is. It's all very authoritarian. It's all top down. You know, I mean, Clyde Belker keeps a very strong hold on his group, and it's all very much, you know, he's the boss, and everyone else has to kind of follow him. And that's not traditional. In a traditional society, he would be completely under the thumb of the community. It'd be the exact opposite. And so, while these were useful and helpful in expanding the discussion of what was possible, in the sense that, you know, I think sometimes when people are busy negotiating, that some things get lost. But I would say, as far as long-term leadership, obviously AIM was not capable of that. And of course, part of it was the assault. A lot of it was the assault. But the other part was just that a media hungry organization attracts media hungry people. And those people are not necessarily great leaders, because you have to have a certain amount of not wanting to center yourself to serve the people. I mean, our leaders, they were the slaves of the people, you know. And so it was, it's not really a reflection of traditional leadership, no. But it did serve a purpose, yes.
So is there potentially a political dimension to the difference you're talking about? That in some ways, the kind of a traditional leadership, traditional cultural dynamics that you're talking about don't necessarily lend themselves to the kind of, you know, I mean, sure, it was media spectacular and stuff, but there was specific objectives that they were involved in. I mean, the occupations that they did had a goal in mind, and that they opened up a kind of space. So there's a kind of radicality to that action, and a kind of willingness to sort of enter in to that.
But that doesn't change the dynamics of the leadership, or the kind of person who's attracted to sit on top of a structure like that.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't change that at all. I mean, and, you know, and with issues like Wounded Knee, I mean, I don't know if you just read the recent article written by Tim Gallego, but, and I had actually interviewed folks there a few years ago, and they feel like what AIM did was came in and destroyed their community without their consent.
Hmm.
And never rebuilt it. And so I think, you know, we have a viewpoint of these things, but when you go into the community and talk to folks, they have another viewpoint. And I think when you work for the people, you constantly have to get their assent, you know, their consent, you know. And you know, when you're riding a media tiger, that's not necessarily the case. That doesn't happen, you know? And so, yeah, I think that they really did help expand the conversation of what is possible. But I do think that the problem with that type of leadership is that it's not a good long-term solution. And that our leadership has to be based in community consent, with the community, the leaders completely accountable to the community, you know, and that is in top-down organizations like these, that is not the case. You know, the man is the all-powerful person. You know, it is very much like what you see like with the Weinstein organization. You know, everyone has to scrape and bow to the needs and ego of that person to get a little scrap from the table. And that's feudalism. That's not our traditions. And so, no, I think that it was an anti-colonial force, but it organized itself in a colonial way.
Mm-hmm. So,
which is why it was so attractive to white people. You know what I mean? And it was something they could understand.
Uh-huh. And again, you're hearing myself, Paul Rowland, host of Wednesday Talk Radio, and Jacqueline Keeler, who's calling in. And we're talking about, it's kind of turned into an overall assessment of the period in time of when the American Indian Movement came into being, and some of its dynamics and its legacy. So what do you see? You know, you were both present at in a couple occasions and also following closely. Obviously monitoring social media and other media, but also had a lot of connections on the inside of the No Dakota Access movement. What did you see? I mean, that being sort of the biggest recent example of Native activism, not to discount the ongoing constant all around the Turtle Island actions of Indigenous peoples, but what kind of dynamics did you, how do you see sort of that in the light of the kinds of criticisms, assessment of the American Indian Movement that you're making?
Yeah, I think definitely the actions at Downey Rock have deep roots with the American Indian Movement. And certainly the Red Warrior Camp was actually, I think, partly run by a chapter of the American Indian Movement. It's based out of Pine Ridge. And yeah, I think there definitely was. I mean, Dennis Banks was at the, he was at the camp. Yeah, I think there are definite ties, and but some of the same problems. I mean, in the sense that the organizers, some of the organizers that came, they were talking to a lot of local folks from Sandy Rock. They feel like their movement was basically poached, and then they were shunted aside from leadership. And so, you know, the movement grew out of the work of young people from Mokpala, which is in the south southern part of the reservation in the South Dakota side, who basically began conducting those runs across the country to get attention to the issue of the pipeline. And talking to those folks, they definitely feel like other Native people came in and just used their movement to fundraise off of, you know, they got very little of the money. And now there's a lot of questions. And they also, the different techniques they used were not in line with the spiritual advice that was given to the actual Stanley Roxy tribal members in ceremony. And so it was concern because they were told to conduct it in a certain way, and it got sort of, well, it got ripped out of their hands and then and done in a totally different way. And so there's the question of when you go to someone else's community, how accountable are you to them as an organizer, as an activist? And the fact is that when you leave, they have to deal with the fallout for the next 40 years, as we saw at Wounded Knee. So I would say that I was trained as a community organizer, and we were told not to go and assume that we know what the communities need, right? To go and run a meeting, ask them, and then every step of the way, you get consent. You know, you get the community's consent for what you're doing. And that element was missing after a while at Downey Rock, when it sort of got taken away by folks who were affiliated with large green nonprofit, the nonprofit industrial complex took it over.
I just want to make a little parenthesis. You mentioned runs. I think that's some that can be to some extent credited also to Dennis Banks. The AIM started the longest walk. They did a number of times, and then Banks himself started to do a bunch of runs for various things. I don't know if he was the first one, but I think he played a major role in that. I know that became a thing that was very important in the development of the Mount Graham struggle. They had a Mount Graham sacred run up to the mountain every year for many years. Probably still do. There's all across the country, and in fact, you talk about there in North Dakota, the youth from Standing Rock had several runs, one all the way to Washington as a way of generating public support and involving the youth. And so I think there's another thing that I think Dennis Banks can be given some credit for in terms of his organizing over the years.
Yeah, I think definitely the long walks, which were, I think, organized by many people in the Bay Area. They generally credit the longest walk to what is his name? I have a street named after him in Oakland. Oh gosh.
Oh, I think I know who you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. I think he was part of that whole development. Although I think that runs and walks were also used in the 1950s and earlier, they've been a constant thing in Native organizing and activism throughout the 20th century.
It's something that really grew out of Native culture and tradition itself, obviously.
Yeah, I think it's definitely... running as part of our traditions, but I think that for the young people at Wakpala, I give them full credit for what they do. I don't know how familiar they were with that, but certainly they were. They started small, like they didn't have any funding to do these runs. The community basically scraped together its dollars to help fund them run, and it was it's in and of itself an incredible achievement that has been really overlooked in the story of Standing Rock.
Mm-hmm. Well, it looks like we do have our first caller. Go ahead, I believe, Tim?
Yeah, hi. Hey, in 1968, I was 16, I went to the Standing Rock Reds with a bunch of other teenagers under the Episcopal Church, and we did some work out there, and I had the impression then that the people just felt defeated and depressed. Mm-hmm. Wasn't much hope, but then AIM came along, right? And later on, 15 years later, I was a community organizing on the Sisseton-Wahpeton Reservation, just south in South Dakota, right? And by that time, everything had changed. Maybe it wasn't just AIM, the organization, but the symbolism of going and seizing the Black Hills and Alcatraz and standing up for your rights and becoming successful and seeing yourself as not a conquered people or a defeated people, maybe as an oppressed people, but a people about to be free. And the difference in the spirit and the hope between that time was incredible to me.
I think you're absolutely right. I think that's what I'm saying. I feel like the work I do today would not be possible without AIM, and that's what I give them credit for. I think the respectability politics of progressive Indian leaders was really hampering, really would not have made what we have today possible without the additional work and inspiration of the American movement.
I think you're right. Mm-hmm. And it's really opened the way. And I'm really happy for the Dakota, Lakota, and Nakota people from all nations.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for calling, Tim.
You're right. Thank you.
Bye-bye. And other people can call in. We've got about 10 minutes left, 503-231-8188. 8-7, where it's a wide-ranging conversation, as generally is the case when I talk with Jacqueline. And we're talking attempt at an overall assessment of sort of AIM and post-AIM Native politics, a lot of the different dimensions. And we started out with that song, the BIA Blues. I was going to talk about that with you, but
that's a great song.
Yeah.
Bill Wapapa is the name of the man who.
That's right.
Bill Wapapa. Yeah.
Yes, I actually met him once. But Floyd Westerman, was a main figure also emerging out of that whole scene. The Buddy Redbow, who I played on my folk show last Thursday, John Trudell, obviously, who was a chairman of the American Indian Movement, who's a leader of the Alcatraz occupation.
Yeah, good morning, Caden. Well,
yeah, I have a question for Jacqueline.
Okay, sorry, I didn't know you were there. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Hello.
Oh, I guess we lost him. Anyway, maybe they'll come back. Actually, Liam, you're going out over the air. I don't know what's going on. So until we get that guest back, I'll just finish my thought, which was the whole explosion of Native music. Then film, and also can be attributed. I mean, look at the Westerman, Banks, Means. They all became Hollywood stars too.
Yeah, I think. I think that it was obviously. I think they owed a lot to their time, to the civil rights movement era, and to the once again a generational size of the community, obviously many of our, that was the generation before them was the first generation that really left the reservation in large numbers to go to war, particularly World War II. And we're exposed to other outside influences. Like Russell Means, he was raised in the Bay Area because his father worked, in military support there. And that's why they live there. There was a lot, that's how the Bay Area community grew out of that, was families coming out to work in the war effort, the war industries.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly a lot of the community here in Portland is the third generation, fourth generation from that. People's grandparents and great grandparents came here to work, in the war industry.
Shipyards, a lot of it. Yeah. I had met some people who are definitely sons and daughters of that generation you're talking about. Looks like we do have a caller. Randy, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you, Jacqueline, for the work that you do.
Thanks.
It's valuable work, and I'm glad you're helping our people. My question is that when he mentioned the idea of AIM organizing, or you mentioned it, trying to do an anti-colonial thing, with colonial methodology. I'm just wondering, and you're an organizer, and then we talk about the different tribes like Standing Rock, and I don't know Standing Rock personally, but I've been around dozens and dozens of different tribes in my life. Isn't that also the case for our tribes, and how do you how do we get through to our tribes to begin to operate in a more traditional way? And then I'll just take my question off the air.
So it's not, I know my comment about, the colonial aspect of it is just because I've done a lot of research and read about and just seen the structure that evolved. And it's an effective structure in a lot of ways, but it's also not our tradition. I think it's hard to comment on individual tribal governments. Obviously, a lot of our tribes tend to become maybe oligarchies in the sense that the tribe is ruled by certain families. It's an accountability. But, I think with the Standing Rock Sioux tribe, there is a level of accountability there. But because, of course, they are elected by the people. and they have constitution. They have a constitution which then holds them accountable to the people to a certain extent. And but of course there are other issues that come into play in smaller communities. We're still dealing with a lot of the fallout. I think, the active work of the U.S. government to deconstruct our traditional societies has had an effect over the last couple, 160 years, and it really, I don't think it's been undone, but certainly we are working at that. And that was what was really exciting about the encampment at Standing Rock, was that it was the first time all of the seven council fires had camped together. And even just living in a camp, I feel like, to me, it just seemed to bring out a lot of our own traditions, our own ways of working with each other. And so I have a lot of hope from that experience. And people got a taste of it, and they want more, I've been continuing to interview young people who were at Standing Rock and who are trying to continue, young people and older people who are trying to continue the work in their own, on their own, Lakota and Dakota reservations. And so I think that was really what was amazing about Standing Rock, was the way we all came together and lived together for a while and had a discussion about how we want to run things. It wasn't perfect. There were some serious things that happened, but not only state violence, but there was some internal issues of safety in the camp. But hopefully we can continue to work on that and bringing back our traditional governance structures.
That's a big question that Randy brings up worthy of an entire show on its own. I kind of wanted to talk a little bit more, brought up the BIA and what the prospects under the Trump administration are. But we do have another caller here. Francis, go ahead. You're on the air.
I remember vaguely. I was a young person in college when the incident when Wounded Knee happened. And I know that Leonard Peltier is still in prison for the only one, I think, that was convicted of killing an FBI agent. And I wonder if you've had the opportunity to get any of his reflections on the movement, and how is his health? I heard that his health is failing, and I haven't heard recently a status on that.
Yeah, I'd heard that too. I did an article in February of this year about he had just, it was his 40th, the 40th anniversary of him being imprisoned. Incarcerated, and I view him as a political prisoner. I mean, or a prisoner of war, really. I talked to his son. His son actually lives here in the Portland area. And
that's what I thought. I met him a couple of years ago.
He's been selling his paintings to help raise money for his father, and the hope was that Obama would sign a would pardon him so he could live out his last years with his family, but that didn't happen. And right. I guess it's even less likely to happen under Trump.
I think it would be really, I wish I could have a conversation with him, because I'm sure he has a lot of insights and everything into entire movement. Yeah.
He wrote a book called My Life is My Sundance, which I would really recommend.
I'm going to read it.
Because that would be his first person perspective on the movement I would recommend that book.
Okay, thanks, Francis. We're just about out of time.
Bye-bye. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Talk in your last minute here, talk about the are we in a new termination era here? It looks like the dismantling of the state apparatus, the regulatory apparatus, is going on just so fast, it's hard to keep track of it all. And is the BIA next on the list?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, obviously, a lot of Native people would have for years wanted the BIA to go away. but the options that Trump's administration have presented, which are, I think Wazinki said that he thought that most tribes would, jump and love the idea of becoming corporations instead of giving up their sovereignty, And they just want to turn our reservation land into yet more, completely, you know, energy dominance, plunder, and it's pretty scary. I think it's I've been working on the issue of Bear's Ears, the book I wrote, Edge of Morning, and you know, of course, the first things that that Trump announced when he got into office was that he was going to basically fast track or try to approve DAPL, the Dakota Access Pipeline, and Keystone XL. And then in April he announced that he wanted to review Bear's Ears and other national monuments, and then we got the news that I guess in early December he's going to come out to Bear's Ears and reduce it by 90% potentially, and open it up to, well, really all there are in the monument itself are uranium mines, and so apparently they really, really want that uranium, which I don't understand why, because it's not very uranium is selling at the lowest point in
unfortunately. On that note, we gotta run because we're plumb out of time. Okay. Thank you so much, Jacqueline, appreciate it. This has been Paul Rowland with Jacqueline Keeler and Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present David Barsamian, Resistance in the Age of Trump, on Sunday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Journalist, author, and activist David Barsamian will be speaking about the broad coalition in opposition to the Trump administration, which includes activists from a range of causes, progressive Democrats, and concerned Republicans. He'll be reflecting on the core issues at stake today and why so many people from such a range of identities and perspectives are challenging the administration. Again, that's KBOO Presents David Barsamian, Resistance in the Age of Trump, on Sunday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8000.